More than 900 of America's top radio stations have made InfoTrack the centerpiece of their public affairs programming. Just ask Julie Depesch, KOIT-FM, San Francisco.
InfoTrack just makes it real easy that you know the topics that are important to your community are going to be covered.
Rob Stadler from Star 94, WSTR-FM, Atlanta.
There's a lot of stuff there that we get credit for public affairs-wise.
Greg Foster, Operations Manager, iHeart, Denver.
I wouldn't hesitate to recommend that it's the ultimate weekend program.
The ultimate weekend program.
With InfoTrack, updating your public file has never been easier. Just add your call letters to InfoTrack's topic sheets and drop them in your public file. That's it.
The paperwork with InfoTrack is much easier. We put it right into our public file and we're completely in compliance right away.
If I didn't have the InfoTrack paperwork, that would be very time consuming. It probably would double my time to complete the report.
It's easy to let somebody else do all the hard work.
InfoTrack is a fast-paced, highly produced 24, 30, or 60 minutes featuring interviews with nationally known guests discussing today's most important issues.
Lots of different voices. The show moves along very quickly.
It's put together very well.
There's no hidden corporate, religious, or political agenda. Just a balanced look at the issues that matter to your community.
The topics are interesting, yeah.
If you want a program that is actually going to make people want to tune in on Sunday mornings, this is the one for you.
And to have it so turnkey, where we just take it off the FTP site, and then we load it into our system, and it's done.
Get InfoTrack. I can't recommend it highly enough.
It's well done, and it's all ready to go, easy to download.
Now, check out InfoTrack for yourself. Then, when you're ready to get started, just send back the agreement or call us to lock in your station. This is InfoTrack, the weekly show with information you should know. Here's what's happening on this week's show.
This week, a special tribute to the late Sally Ride, America's first woman in space, and her mission to bring a love of math and science to girls.
Try to break down those lingering stereotypes and make sure that girls get the message that, you know, there are lots of women who have great careers in sciences and engineering.
Then, in the aftermath of the Colorado tragedy, we'll talk to a former Navy SEAL who has potentially life-saving advice for you and your family you'll want to hear.
In these active shooter scenarios, you cannot wait to be rescued. If anyone's ever dialed 911, it takes tens of minutes for these responders to show up, and that's too late.
Those two stories, and much more, are coming your way on this edition of InfoTrack. Stay with us. Our show will begin right after this.
InfoTrack, the weekly show with information you should know. Here's your host, Chris Whitting.
Following word of this week's passing of America's first woman in space, Sally Ride, we turn to our InfoTrack archives to bring you an interview we did with the famed astronaut in 2006. In it, Sally Ride shares her mission to bring a love of math and science to girls.
She was the first American woman in space and holds a bachelor's, master's, and PhD in physics. Of course, she is Sally Ride. Sally, welcome to InfoTrack.
Thank you. Great to be with you.
Sally, your big project these days is an organization called Sally Ride Science. What's that all about?
It's a company that creates entertaining science events, programs, and publications, primarily for girls who are interested in science and math. But we also hold programs that involve boys and write publications for boys as well. And our whole focus is catching kids in upper elementary school through middle school and reminding them how interesting science is, because they thought it was interesting in elementary school, and just capturing their enthusiasm and trying to keep them interested and keep them involved in science.
Your website has some fascinating statistics about girls in particular and how they seem to lose interest. They're pretty troubling numbers of the percentage of women who hold jobs in science or engineering, for example, aren't they?
They are. Those numbers, the percentages of women in science and engineering, have been going up steadily since 1970, and the numbers are a lot better than they used to be. But it's still troubling. Women now make up about 11% of engineers in this country, about 20% of scientists. And, you know, every company that you can name is furiously trying to recruit women in the sciences and engineering. But they find that they're not coming out of colleges and universities with degrees in those areas in the numbers that they could really easily absorb. The interesting thing, though, and the reason that we think that there's reason for optimism, is that in elementary school, fully two-thirds of the kids 68% of boys and 66% of girls will tell you they like science. And so the girls are out there. The girls in elementary school have the interest, they've got the enthusiasm, they've got the aptitude, they score just as well as on tests as the boys do in science and math. And so we think that if we can just come up with opportunities for those girls to retain their interest as they go on to middle school and high school, that, as I said, there's reason for optimism. And it appears to be primarily societal reasons, you know, lingering stereotypes. Important to be cool when you're in middle school, may not be cool to be the smartest girl in the math class. It's reasons like that that girls start to drift away from science in numbers greater than boys do. And right about middle school is the time when it starts to happen.
How much of a role do you think outright discrimination plays in women not choosing scientific fields?
I really don't think that discrimination plays a role anymore. You know, it certainly did 20, 30, 40 years ago. But now, that's not really the case. A young girl growing up today can be anything that she wants to be. But what is still out there are some of the subtle biases, some of the perceptions that parents, grandparents, teachers might still hold, some of the messages that society still sends through TV or through magazines that, you know, girls are very smart. They pick up on even these subtle messages and begin to wonder whether those careers are really the best ones for them or whether they should go into, you know, law or business. And I think that it's still important for us to try to break down those lingering stereotypes and make sure that the girls get the message that, you know, there are lots of women who have great careers who really are passionate about what they do in sciences and engineering.
Could you give me maybe a specific example of what made a difference for you as a young person, something maybe that your parents or a teacher did that gave you the confidence to think, hey, maybe I really could be an astronaut?
Well, you know, I think you hit on it when you said the word confidence. Neither of my parents were scientists, and they had this daughter who just loved science. It would have been very easy for them to kind of subtly shift me over towards something that they understood better or that they could have helped me with my homework on. But they didn't do that. They thought that if I liked science, that was good enough for them, and they'd help me whatever way they could. But then I had two teachers in high school who were science teachers who spent a fair amount of time with me. And the reason that they were important to me is that they helped me build my confidence in myself. And I needed that then. A lot of kids growing up, both boys and girls, need their confidence, their self-esteem boosted when they're in middle school or high school. And, you know, I frankly just wasn't sure whether I was smart enough to go on in science when I got into college. And they said, you know, you don't get dumber as you get older. You know, if you're getting the A's and the B's now, you'll be able to get the A's and the B's when you go on into college. You need to have confidence that you can continue on.
We're talking to pioneering astronaut Sally Ride, who founded an organization called Sally Ride Science to empower girls to explore the world of science and to have the foundation they need to go on to careers in science, math, or engineering. Sally, you also attended an all-girls high school, and the statistics show that single-sex schools do have a much higher level of learning than co-ed schools. How much of a difference do you think that made for you?
You know, in retrospect, I think that that probably did make quite a difference for me. I went to a public school through junior high and then went to an all-girls school for 10th, 11th, and 12th grade. And I didn't go there for academic reasons. I actually went there because they had a very good tennis team and I was there on a tennis scholarship. But in hindsight, looking back on it, I think it was really critical to my science career that I went to this all-girls high school. You know, there, all the kids in the class were girls. I was in a calculus class. I was in a chemistry class. The girls were expected to do well. You know, there were very high expectations for us. And I think one of the issues that we still face to some extent today, but not nearly as much as when I was growing up, is that expectations, particularly in math and science, were higher for boys than they were for girls. It wasn't considered quite as important for a girl to do well in math or in science when I was growing up. But at this all-girls school, that was not the case. You know, I was expected to do well. And I think that that was absolutely critical, as I said, as I, you know, kind of look back on my career. I think it was really important that I got that boost in high school.
I have a young daughter, so I'm going to ask this on behalf of all parents. What kind of advice would you give parents to help their daughters when they hit that 6th, 7th, 8th grade level?
You know, parents are, of course, so important to this. And I think that the advice that I'd give to parents is to just try to support your daughter's interests wherever they might lie, and to appreciate that she may need special encouragement if she's got an aptitude or an interest in science or math, because it would be up to you to help combat some of those, as I said, lingering stereotypes that she's going to encounter, possibly from her peers, possibly from some of her teachers, possibly from some of the counselors at school, and to start to gather the information about female role models, make sure that she can put a female face on these careers as she's growing up, and make sure that she understands some of the cool stuff that scientists and engineers go on to do.
Is there anything that you would suggest parents do to put pressure on their school to prevent that dumbing down of girls during middle school?
The more pressure that parents can put on the schools, the better. I think that if parents can really be a voice to say, you know, it's critical for our daughters to be well-educated, to understand their opportunities, because they are going to be part of the workforce, and we want them to be as well-trained as our boys are. And to get that message across to the teachers, to the administrators, is critical.
And you have a number of resources on your website for Sally Ride Science also, right?
We do. We have resources for parents. We have resources for teachers. We're adding to them all the time. We have several programs for girls. Speaking of role models, we've actually got several publications for girls that feature women in different areas of science, health sciences, engineering sciences, space sciences, earth sciences, so that they really can become familiar with the women who have gone on to have great careers in these areas. The website address is sallyridescience.com.
Just as a final thought, any words of encouragement for young girls who may be listening?
I think the thing for them to remember is that they can go on and do whatever they want to do. It's up to them, and it's the middle school years, the high school years, where they're building the foundations that will allow them to go on and do whatever it is they want to do.
Well, it was an honor to have you on the show today. Sally Ride, the first American woman in space and now the founder and CEO of Sally Ride Science, thank you very much for joining us on InfoTrack.
Thank you very much.
And for InfoTrack, I'm Roy Mackey.
Next, a former Navy SEAL shares potentially life-saving advice that could keep you and your family alive. Stay tuned.
Stick around. There's more InfoTrack straight ahead. Now, InfoTrack continues. Once again, here's Chris Whitting.
In the aftermath of the recent shooting tragedy in Colorado, many Americans are asking themselves how they might have reacted had they been there. Our next guest says survival in such a situation might hinge on your preparation and knowledge. And he should know, as a former Navy SEAL and a Special Operations Intelligence and Security Specialist. Let's welcome Brandon Webb to InfoTrack. And let's talk about Aurora, Colorado, and how you think the people in that theater might have been better prepared to protect themselves.
Well, when I read about Aurora, I was on a red-eye flight from California to New York, and I just started thinking, let's not let these people die in vain. And, you know, as a country, what can we do to learn from this and raise awareness? I think the biggest thing for people is to just take a few seconds and really be aware of your surroundings. So there's an awareness factor. You know, I see it in major cities where people at night are walking down streets and they're just sucked into their smartphone and they're typing away and really not paying attention to the surroundings. And in that situation, you really become a victim. When bad people are out looking, you know, they're looking for people like that who aren't paying attention. In the case of Aurora, you know, it's just a horrific situation to find yourself in. What people commonly do, they've done studies, you know, and you look at Virginia Tech, where this guy locked people in a room, and you have 17 people against one. It takes one person to come up with a plan and mobilize everyone to overpower these individuals or escape, if you have escape routes, which were definitely in place in this theater in Colorado. Take a moment and think self-rescue. You know, what can I do to get myself out of this situation? Because I trained snipers when I was a SEAL and as a sniper instructor, and moving targets are hard to hit. In this situation, most of these guys, are not proficient with the firearms. In this particular situation, this guy was weighted down with body armor and a Kevlar helmet. There's smoke. God, just a few seconds for people to think, okay, I got to get myself out of this situation, and more lives could be saved. And, you know, I talked about basic self-defense tools that are non-lethal. You know, everyone gets caught up in carrying firearms, but I carry a flashlight. It's a 500 lumen flashlight. It fits in my pocket. I can take it anywhere on the airplane. It will blind somebody in the daylight, and it's a very effective tool. And I did a self-defense post on the site that I run, softrep.com, and I've already had emails from women that have said, look, I bought this light, and it got me out of a potential situation at night when I had a guy following me in the parking lot, and I shined the light on him. It stunned him and gave me enough time to get in my car and drive away. So I just want to raise awareness so people realize in these active shooter scenarios, you cannot wait to be rescued. First responders, they have a challenging job, but if anyone's ever dialed 911, it takes tens of minutes, if not hours, sometimes for these responders to show up, and that's too late.
Brandon, what you're saying is obviously if you get into one of these horrifying situations, there are things you can do. But also, I think you're suggesting that before a situation even develops, you need to be aware of your surroundings and perhaps position yourself so that if something does happen, you'll be in an advantageous position. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, exactly. You know, even today, I don't go into a restaurant. I always sit with my back to something solid, and so I have a good visual of my surroundings. It's a shame. You know, you want to enjoy the freedoms that we have in this country, but, you know, not putting yourself in situations where it's an opening night or opening day for an amusement park. One of the major reasons I didn't go to London to take my son to the Olympics this year is I think there's a very real threat of a terrorist activity. As an example, taking my kids to Disney World, I won't go in the summer in peak hours. I'll go off peak because I know a lot of these terrorists, domestic and international, they want the biggest bang for the buck. This guy knew that this opening night was going to be packed. If you're going to go to something like this, a concert or an amusement park, knowing where the emergency exits are, rehearsing it in advance.
We're talking with Brandon Webb on InfoTrack. He's a former Navy SEAL and Special Operations Intelligence and Security Specialist. And we're talking about how you can stay safe even in a really terrifying situation. In terms of carrying a weapon, which is permitted in 49 states, and we should note that the theater chain in Aurora had a gun-free zone policy, you advocate not just carrying a weapon when it's legal, but really knowing how to use it. Could you talk about that?
Sure. A lot of people, they buy a gun, they go to the shooting range, they learn how to shoot it, and they keep it in the home. And if it's a concealed carry situation or in the home situation, they don't practice how to use it when they have to. And it's not hard to imagine an intruder in the house and, okay, what am I going to do? Where are my escape points? Because you don't want to sit there and have a gunfight with anybody, but you want to use it to get yourself and your family to safety and to rehearse those scenarios in advance. And also in this situation, in Aurora, if somebody had been carrying concealed and had been properly trained, it's a very good chance that this gunman would have been taken down. But you have to train, not just go to the shooting range. You have to train for these certain environments. You know, there's a lot of stuff that we do in the SEAL team where it's mental rehearsal only, and your central nervous system oftentimes, if you vividly imagine these certain scenarios and practice them in your head, it's like practicing them for real. And rehearsing that in advance really helps prepare people to deal with these situations.
Brandon, it's one thing to be taking care of yourself to save your own life, but what if you're a parent with children? What advice would you have for parents in terms of helping to keep their family safe?
I would say the biggest advice is to talk to the kid. Whatever the situation is, if it's an intruder, you know, you get the family together and say, look, if something like this happens, this is what we're going to do as a family. You know, run for the back door, and we're going to meet here and pick a location and just talk about it and run them through it. Kids are smart. I talk to my own children who are 10 and under, and when we go to the music park or somewhere, we know what's going on. Like, I've talked to them, okay, this is what's going to happen. If we get separated, here's the plan. If an emergency happens, this is what we're going to do. And so just having a plan in place, whether it's a fire, an intruder, or a natural disaster, or, God forbid, a terrorist situation out in town, you have to think about it and have a plan in place. when the emergency happens, it's not the time to start thinking about, okay, what do I do? Because it's too late, and people get frozen in fear, and then it's too late.
Brandon Webb, former Navy SEAL and a Special Operations Intelligence and Security Specialist with what could be some life-saving information, and you can get more of that at his website, which is sofrep.com, S-O-F-R-E-P.com. And also, check out his New York Times bestseller, The Red Circle. Brandon, we want to thank you so much for joining us on InfoTrack.
Yeah, it's great to be on the show. I appreciate it.
You're listening to InfoTrack. To learn more about our guests or listen to past shows, visit InfoTrack online at TalkZone.com.
You're told over and over that you need to prepare yourself for retirement by saving money and staying healthy. But is your local community prepared for the coming tidal wave of aging baby boomers? InfoTrack's Roy Mackey is here to take a look. Roy?
Thanks, Chris. Sandy Markwood is the CEO of the National Association of Area Agencies on Aging, which sponsored a report on those boomers titled The Maturing of America, Getting Communities on Track for an Aging Population. Sandy, welcome to InfoTrack.
Thank you for having me.
Let's talk about the demographics for a moment. What percentage of the population, how many Americans will be hitting their senior years and how soon?
Well, currently, 12% of the U.S. population is in that magic 65-plus age category. But by 2030, there will be 71.5 million people in the United States who will be over the age of 65, twice their number in the year 2000. And at that point, one in every five Americans will be an older adult.
Wow. I think the average person is kind of surprised to hear that their local community needs to do a lot to be prepared for an aging population like that. What kinds of things are needed to get a community ready?
It's really going to impact almost everything a city or county does, from transportation, housing, public safety, parks and recreation, workforce development. Even issues like economic development and taxation will be impacted by this exploding population of older adults.
And your study had some pretty sobering results in terms of how many communities are even beginning to plan for this.
Well, at this point, this study, I think, should serve as a wake-up call to America's communities, because what we found is that only 46% of cities and counties in the U.S. are even thinking of planning for an aging population. Some have started to take initial steps, but the majority of cities and counties across the country really haven't started to take the steps they need to plan for an aging population. And it takes planning at the community level to be able to meet the needs of an aging population, whether it is a matter of developing more transportation options to meet the needs of older adults who may need to limit or eliminate driving altogether, changing zoning or subdivision ordinances to be able to develop new accessible housing on smaller or easier to maintain lots, developing job retraining and lifelong learning opportunities for older adults. All of these programs and services are easy for communities to do, but it takes some planning, and now's the time to do it.
Yeah, it sounds like this could be very difficult to do in just a year or two. It would be something that would be more of a long-term plan.
It will be a long-term plan. There are incremental things that communities can do. Not all of the different policies, programs, and services take a great deal of money. Again, what we found from the survey is there are a number of communities that have already begun to do incremental changes to meet the needs of an aging population. Laredo, Texas offers smaller trash cans that are more easily manipulated for an older adult to get to the curb. That's an easy, doable thing for a community to do. To be able to enlarge road signs and to make them in larger print, more reflective, easier to read by an aging driver, better improved pedestrian crosswalks. These are services that really benefit older adults for sure, but they can also benefit the entire community, because the goal here is really for communities to be livable communities for all ages.
Some of the things you're describing, like road signs, are things that only government could do, but are there things that local community service groups can do to help?
There are always going to be the need for traditional aging services, which are really a key component of what happens at the local level, and community organizations are the backbone of that. Being able to provide chore services, being able to provide friendly visiting services, caregiver support opportunities for caregivers of older adults. But there are also a number of opportunities that communities can offer older adults in the areas of volunteerism and civic engagement. Because the other part of an aging population, there are challenges in service delivery, but there are huge opportunities that older adults offer.
Sandy, do you have a website where people can get additional information?
We sure do. Our website for the National Association of Area Agencies on Aging is n4a.org.
Our guest on InfoTrack is Sandy Markwood. She is the CEO of the National Association of Area Agencies on Aging. Sandy, we appreciate you being here on InfoTrack.
Thank you so much for having me.
For InfoTrack, I'm Roy Mackey.
And that's it for this edition of InfoTrack. To get more information about our guests and topics, you can find InfoTrack online at TalkZone.com. InfoTrack is a production of Syndication Networks of Chicago. Internet services provided by Pear.com, the home of world-class web hosting. Special thanks this week to InfoTrack contributor Roy Mackey and our executive producer Randy Meyer. I'm Chris Whitting, inviting you to catch us next time on another edition of InfoTrack.
InfoTrack. Just send back the agreement or call toll-free to lock in your station. Get on track with your public affairs programming. Get InfoTrack.